Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. We are in the home stretch of the summer and for summer vacations, but the markets haven't been quiet and they likely won't be this week either. Now, after digesting inflation data last week, the main focus for this week will be on Fed Chair Jay Powell's speech at the Jackson Hole Symposium coming up on Friday. So joining us today on a Monday morning to discuss this all, glad to welcome back Jason Dreho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. So, Jason, as always, nice to be at the table with you. Welcome back. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Monday.
So, Jason, let's begin with the July inflation data that was released last week. What did the data tell us about the state of inflation, the impacts of tariffs, and how it could evolve from here?
Well, the headline for CPI inflation was kind of in line with expectations, so a good report from that respect. Mm-hmm. The key thing is to look at the core CPI data. It rose 32 basis points month over month, basically in line with expectations, which is around 0.3, or if you want to get to second decimal place, maybe slightly higher, but basically right in line with expectations. And that meant on a year-over-year basis, it rose to just over 3%, like you rounded up, like 3.1%. The headline inflation numbers, which will include food and energy, up 20 basis points month over month, and it is at 2.7% year over year. If you look at your kind of core goods prices, which are probably the best indication of tariffs because we're importing goods, we're not necessarily importing services. A lot of services are through different means. Those rose core goods prices. Excluding cars, rose 22 basis points. The prior month, it was 55. So you could look at it and say, perhaps that's a step down from prior month. Therefore, the tariffs are not having an impact. But the context is that, goods inflation had been running, negative or kind of flat, for the past couple of years. So the fact that it's actually at this level is historically unusual. It definitely is a sign that there is an impact of tariffs. On a month-to-month basis, sometimes there are issues with specific categories or areas that are really elevated that could, it could be a certain part of a goods that causes inflation to go up. So, month-to-month kind of volatility, but the direction of travel still suggests that there's more in the pipeline for goods inflation that reflects the tariffs. The inflation data we got last week that wasn't quite as good was the PPI data. Whether you look at this is the producer price index, more kind of thought of inputs, as opposed to the final consumption, all that is CPI. Whether you look at the PPI number overall, PPI excluding food and energy, or even exclude trade services, it all increased significantly more than expected. The headline number was 0.9% month over month. Consensus going in was 0.2, 0.3 in that range. So sizable beat there overall. There's obviously a question of what's the correlation between PPI and CPI? If you have higher PPI, does that imply, this is going to feed through to lead to higher CPI down the line? Historically, there's not a great relationship. So not a good number, certainly, but isn't indicative necessarily of, a big surge of inflation coming. But it is kind of consistent mm-hmm. with perhaps, the tariff pipeline of inflation, building overall. So the takeaway is roughly in line with expectations. That's why we saw on Tuesday when the inflation data came out, the CPI data specifically, that the markets rallied a lot on that news. You saw, the S&P 500 was up over 1% that day. Small caps, which tend to be more economically sensitive, were up over 2%. Some of that's more of a short squeeze. But again, the market viewed as we expect inflation to go higher. It will continue to go higher before it sort of rolls over. But it's not rising dramatically in a way that is showing that perhaps the tariff impact will be even better than expected or higher than expected. So overall, the trend we expect, it's probably going to get worse before it gets better, but this is sort of well known by the markets at this point in time, and they reacted accordingly.
So, Jason, on this question of data, there are new concerns about potential political interference in producing economic data. This after President Trump fired the BLS commissioner a couple of weeks ago. Now, in your recent blog titled Data Concerns of a Different Sort, you suggest that this risk is low, but that there are other reasons why data quality is deteriorating. Can you elaborate on what those concerns are and their implications?
So a common question I've gotten the past 2 weeks since Trump fired the head of the BLS, and this is the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Mm-hmm. They produce, among other data, the monthly payrolls report, the unemployment rate data, but also CPI data. So probably the two biggest things that the investors care about is labor market inflation data comes from the BLS. So the concern would be, is this going to lead to some sort of political interference, adjusting of numbers, whatever might be that would call into question the accuracy of the data and reflecting what is going on in the economy. I think that risk is still low. There's institutional challenges to it. It's also not necessarily in the president's or any president's best interest to do this, to be seen as manipulating the data. They may want to have better data, but ultimately there's other sources that would indicate if inflation's an issue or not. Mm-hmm. I think the point I would make in the blog is that this sort of adds to, at the margin, sort of already kind of concerns and issues with data quality that have really grown in the pandemic and post-pandemic period, but to some extent even began prior to 2020. And you can break this down into different kind of ways of like, why is there sort of issues with the data? One is response rates to surveys. A lot of the data, especially the first cut of the data, well, actually all the data, but certainly the first cut is based on surveys. This includes for the unemployment rate and the payrolls, there are surveys, the establishment surveys, surveying businesses, asking them a number of questions about their employment, hiring practices, things of that sort. The unemployment rate is a household survey asking people essentially if they are working, are they looking for work, things of that sort. In general, response rates to all sorts of surveys have dropped dramatically from pre to post pandemic. To me, a good one is the JOLTS indicator, which is the job openings every month. The response rate for the 2010s, was average was around 65%. Since then, during the pandemic, it felt as low as 30%. Now it's gone to 35%. So a 30 percentage point decline. When you get sort of low response rates, it just means your sample that you're getting from is less representative of the overall population. Mm-hmm. Therefore, your confidence interval is going to be wider and can also lead to bigger month-to-month variations because it just do more to poor data sampling as opposed to actual changes in the underlying economy. So poor response rates have been already an issue. Seasonal adjustment factors, we get seasonal patterns in data. People spend a lot and consume a lot in November, December going into the holidays. It drops off in January, February. If you actually saw the raw data, you'd get this really hard to decipher sawtooth pattern, which would be noisy. So you try to smooth that out to say, account for these typical patterns. The pandemic distorted a lot of that. Think about what happened in April of 2020. Businesses shut down, unemployment rate surged. Fast forward a year later, vaccinations were rolling out, the economy was opened up, and suddenly hiring surged. So how do you adjust for seasonal patterns in that way? That's been an issue. We already saw that just in the past couple months, where the June employment data was relatively strong, but half of that was due to education. And it was a bit of a puzzle, going into summer, usually teachers and people working in education are laid off or not working. Mm-hmm. Why should there be a surge? The July data sort of revised that down, but the initial reading led to this kind of quirk. So these kind of things are sort of popping up more and more. They just lead to noise in the data. Immigration surged in 21, 22, 23. It was contributing to, ultimately in hindsight, with why job growth is strong, yet the unemployment rate could rise because the labor force was essentially increasing. That only really became apparent in the spring of 2024. Now immigration has slowed dramatically. Deportations are picking up. But even just the risk of deportations, perhaps some people are not choosing to go to show up to work. How is this impacting employment? It's unclear. We've seen the last 3 months an average of 35,000 new jobs created per month, but the unemployment rate has basically stayed constant. Mm-hmm. So again, what's kind of going on there? So these are examples. In addition to the fact that the U.S. economy today is very different than it was 50 years ago, a lot of the data is based more on goods and manufacturing and production, yet that share of the economy has shrunk, whereas other activity, anything that is online, perhaps, has not been actually kind of accurately measured and captured. So all sorts of implications of the data sort of getting worse. What does it mean for the markets? More volatility because you get month-to-month swings in the data points. Something I think a lot about is you get oscillations in the market narrative. So the market will look at the economic data and investors say, oh, well, based on this, it looks like it's a reflation. Mm-hmm. Growth going higher, rate inflation going higher. It could be stagflation, growth going lower, inflation going higher. Goldilocks, growth up, inflation's down. But some of this could be because of false inference of the data. You see the data, think, oh, this is one of these regimes. Mm-hmm. Turns out that's just noisy data. 2-3 months later, we get new data to change it. Last year in 2024, we went through a period of time where the market was sort of pricing Goldilocks, then to reflation, then concerns about stagflation, then ultimately kind of growth slowdowns, then by the end of the year back to reflation. So this leads to big kind of market swings. So as an investor, it's something that you have to be acknowledged of, aware of it. This is the reality of what the markets are, what the data is like. It's hard to time this kind of stuff. It's hard to kind of have confidence. So the best thing you can offer to do is just sort of have a more of a medium-term view, 12 plus months, mm-hmm. and kind of trying to look through this noise. And if you can, when the markets do oscillate a lot, if it creates opportunities and dislocations, you can step in. But I think this is just a reality. And so not overly emphasize some of the near-term volatility noise, because a lot of cases it will be noise given the data is just not as quite as good as it was before.
So a lot of considerations there, Jason. And data concerns, of course, matter to the Fed as well. On that point, what do you expect to hear from Fed Chair Jay Powell during his speech this week at the Jackson Hole Central Bank Symposium?
Well, the title of Powell's speech is Economic Outlook and Framework Review, which is not exactly a barn burner title.
Right.
But there will probably be more interesting things that he says. The market will be most focused on any guidance he gives regarding the September rate cut. In recent years, he has been very explicit about or tipping his hand very clearly of the Fed's intention either to cut rates or, if we go back to 2022, you know, raise rates and raise rates perhaps more aggressively. This time, it's, you know, he may disappoint the markets and not being, you know, overly definitive. You know, the data and sort of the trend certainly seems to be towards the Fed looking to cut rates in September. There's a, you know, definitely a valid case for them to do that, given some of the weakness in the labor market. But there also is a full month of data to come up before then that could still kind of, again, given what I just mentioned on data quality, it could suddenly show a picture that is not as bad as investors fear, or actually worse, that would justify a bigger move. So Powell's unlikely to want to, you know, kind of really commit to anything in particular and say that things are still sort of data dependent. If you look at market pricing for the odds of a September cut, after the CPI inflation data that came out that was in line with expectations last Tuesday, the probability for a September cut in the market was around 95-96%. As of Monday morning, it's down to 83%. But by year end, it's still a little over, you know, 2.1 cuts. So, you know, pushing a little bit out, you're given some of the more kind of, you know, recent data. Now, one thing that Powell could do aside from giving guidance for September and beyond is that, you know, every 5 years, the Fed does a review of monetary policy strategy, tools, and communications. 5 years ago, 2020, it began before the pandemic, began, that this review did. Ultimately, that review led to the firm adopting average inflation targeting, the idea being that while inflation was continually falling short of the 2% target for the 2010s, if you do an average inflation targeting, that means you allow inflation to go above 2% and below 2%. Now, in hindsight, that was probably an inopportune time to launch that, given the pandemic and the inflation that ensued. But, you know, this is not somebody that they, you know, had foresight to know that was going to happen at the time. In practical terms, some of what it meant is that the Fed was basically saying our models to predict inflation weren't great. We actually need to see actual inflation above 2%, and then we will adjust accordingly. Now, they don't need to sort of, you know, follow this anymore because while inflation's continuing to run above 2%, it's going to be forecast by the Fed itself to be above 2% for the rest of at least the next 2 years. So they will probably make some adjustments in terms of that. In effect, they already have. There could be further adjustments in terms of Fed communication, you know, the use of the dot plot, the SEP, the summary of economic projections. Also, even if the review doesn't do it, you know, the prospect of a new Fed chair and sort of changes, you know, from that could also impact sort of, you know, the approach to Fed policy. What Powell also might do, since it's very likely his last speech, would be kind of very, very surprising if this wasn't, is follow what his predecessors as Fed chair, Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, Janet Yellen, they all used their last speech at Jackson Hole to kind of offer a bit of reflection, you know, on you know, monetary policy, on the Fed, you know, describing some of the positive contributions that monetary policy has to the nation's fortunes. Given concerns about Fed independence, that could be also a part of like the importance of, you know, the Fed being able to conduct it without political interference. So that is sort of impossible. So as much as investors want a definitive, here's what we're going to do, that's unlikely. Instead, there could be guidance of like, here's, you know, the role of the Fed, here's the role of the Fed going forward as you know, we think our policy framework should be.
Well, it will be interesting to hear from Chairman Powell on Friday. I'm sure we'll cover some takeaways during our conversation next Monday, Jason. To close out for today, let's end with a recap of CIO's investment recommendations. What are the key ideas that you want to highlight to our listeners this week?
Well, you know, sort of, you know, similar to what we've been saying the past couple weeks, the fundamental story had, you know, did not change. The inflation data is sort of in line with our expectations. We think that's still playing out from an equity market perspective. Still believe this is a bull market with good upside of a, you know, at the medium term horizon, even though in the near term there could be volatility and disappointment, whether it's because the data doesn't, you know, proceed as expected, the Fed disappoints, political, geopolitical issues of all sorts. So kind of thinking about that narrative and the volatility, just kind of, you know, kind of look through that on a 12-month basis, you're relatively constructive. So if you happen to be underweight equities, a lot of cash, you know, think about putting that to work and not trying to get overly cute on the timing, because the markets could keep grinding higher before there is a pullback. the same sort of secular stories and themes that we like, whether it is, you know, AI, you know, kind of energy transition, mm-hmm. you know, are attractive, but also more tactically, things like financials, you know, continue to sort of benefit, and we expect will benefit from sort of a deregulation push that is ongoing, and changes at the Fed could further kind of accelerate that as well. Within fixed income, you know, I would note that as of this morning, investment grade corporate bond spreads are like at a 25-year tight. That applies to much of credit. So to take a lot of risk in sort of fixed income feels like you're not necessarily getting rewarded. Mm-hmm. So kind of stay up in quality is kind of a key message there. Buy quality bonds. And while the rates, you know, have kind of oscillated a little bit, we do think, you know, sticking more in the intermediate part of interest rate exposure, like a 4 or 5 years, is the prudent way to go. Because while the Fed may cut, we did see like last year where rates actually rose a lot out of concerns about inflation or growth didn't kind of slow down. And the final thing is, given a lot of geopolitical issues going on Friday with President Trump meeting, right. you know, President Putin, again, a meeting today in the White House with Trump, Zelensky, and other European leaders, there is geopolitical risk. Gold has proven to be a fairly effective hedge. So it is, you know, the same kind of message, but, you know, the takeaway over the past week is some way the main story has not changed.
Well, a helpful touch base, Jason, as always. Thank you for keeping us current on what's happening in markets, CIO's interpretation, and of course, guidance when it comes to positioning. It will be a busy week ahead, so looking forward to continuing with our conversation next Monday.
You're welcome.
Have a great week, Jason. Thank you. And again, I want to highlight Jason's latest blog, which Jason has been making reference to this morning. Data Concerns of a Different Sort is now available up on ubs.com/CIO for clients of UBS, please reach out to your UBS financial advisor if you would like to receive a copy of Jason's blog directly. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.